right, hello everyone, and welcome back to today's podcast. This week is going to be all about defining science. Specifically, today's show is going to focus on the history of the scientific method, what exactly the method is itself, and some assumptions that scientists have to make, philosophical assumptions, when they formulate theories. Also, some word usage will be cleared up that creationists and intelligent design advocates tend to take advantage of by the fact that layman people don't understand, often don't understand, the difference between things like theory, law, and religion. And we'll also be discussing two creationist claims today. One is on evolution and how creationists claim it will lead to a lack of morality. And the next one is the famous, if we descended from monkeys, why are there still monkeys around? These are the two claims we'll be discussing today. However, first, I'd like to talk a bit about my week, because it's been very horrendous, especially the weekend. On Saturday, I woke up to about 2.5 feet of water all over our property, because what happened, we had a windstorm. If anybody's in the Northwest, they'll remember the windstorm we had on Saturday night. Winds reached about 85 in some places in Oregon. Well, what happened was I live on the beach, and we had a bulkhead. And when the wind came and the rain, the storm broke the bulkhead, and high tide came around, and all the water rushed in and flooded the neighborhood. Well, we've got most of it pumped out. We still have a bit of our driveway covered, but we're clearing that out slowly, so we should have most of the water gone by the end of the week. However, the problem is the soil is saturated, so we won't be able to use our septic for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. So that's a real big problem. And then on Sunday, I watched the Super Bowl, which was one of the worst Super Bowls I've ever seen. I won't get started on that because some people might be Steelers fans here, and I don't want to offend them. So let's just get right on to the creationist claim number one. This is that accepting evolution leads to an utter lack of morals. Creationists like to claim that natural selection implies that people should constantly be fighting with one another. Eric Hovind, for instance, who is the son of famous Kent Hovind, states that it was Hitler's religion during the Third Reich in Germany. You can find this on their videos. They have them on Google. What Eric Hovind doesn't actually seem to know is that Hitler made it plain in Mein Kampf that he was a Christian. He stated that by defending himself against the Jew, he was doing the work of the Lord. A famous phrase during the Third Reich's kind of reign in Germany was Gott mit uns, which basically means God with us. There was a lot more than this that Hitler did to identify himself as a Christian person when he was leading Germany during World War II. However, if we are to assume, let's just say that Hitler was not a true Christian, as people would like to say, and that he didn't actually believe that he was doing the work of the Lord, and that his book and the phrase Gott mit uns was purely propaganda, we still say that just because Hitler accepted, maybe he accepted evolution, that doesn't mean that evolution will lead to an utter lack of morals, any more than the fact that Hitler accepted gravity. Does that mean that we're going to lead to a lack of morals from that? No, obviously not. Gravity has nothing to do with morality, and neither does evolution. By saying that, I don't mean that our morals have not evolved from previous our ancestors. What I'm saying is that it should not have no ethical consequences on the facts of reality. And this is what's known as the is-ought problem. This was discovered by the philosopher David Hume. It involves someone making a claim of what ought to be, due to natural facts, what is. Just because evolution involves natural selection does not make it moral to go around murdering people, and it's a logical fallacy to think so. This is almost indistinguishable from what is known as the naturalistic fallacy. Again, this involves drawing ethical conclusions from the facts of nature that creatures are in competition with one another. However, it also stems from a fact that creationists don't really understand what natural selection implies. Often, natural selection does not involve direct conflict between one species and another. It often involves geographic differences or mutations that are indiscriminate in the way they affect a creature and how their environment is going to react. Natural selection does not imply that it's okay to murder. What natural selection is basically showing is that the fittest will survive in their environment. Does that mean it's moral to go murder people because they aren't as strong as you, maybe, or, you know, anything like that? No, it's obviously not correct, and again, this is a naturalistic fallacy, or the is-ought problem, proposed by David Hume. However, to top this all off, I just finished a book called Origin of Virtue. It is a book on the evolution of human morality, and it says a very different thing than what creationists would like to think that evolution says about the nature of morality. Morality did not evolve as humans constantly fighting with one another and every other creature on Earth, constantly combating every other species until they ultimately wipe each other out. There is no better in a kind of absolute sense. It's all relative to the environment that everything exists in. Now, if humans and apes are not in direct conflict with one another, they're not going to be, you know, murdering one another off like some kind of gang war. Humans, by themselves, are pretty social creatures, and we have a higher view. We're actually able to think about morality. We have a more advanced culture than apes or monkeys or any other society does, because we have language and art. And human beings, the only reason we have these kind of wars is due to the fact that we have isolated tribes of people with differing views. It's not due to the fact that, well, we think, you know, morality should stem from the natural world. We've had wars for thousands of years before the theory of evolution was even thought up. We've had genocide occur even before evolution was thought up. So I don't see how Eric Hovind, Kent Hovind, or any creationist or intelligent design advocate could blame evolution for the cause of all these wars, violences, slavery, you name it, it's bad, evolution does it to them. This is not the way things are, and I don't know how people can twist the reality of things to believe it is so that way. Again, I would highly recommend reading the book The Origin of Virtue. It's very interesting on how human evolution is laid out and how the most appropriate way for societies to interact with one another and how individuals should react with one another in a society. Game theory, they mentioned game theory a lot in this book and how there have been different tests run that say, well, humans would get along if, you know, better if they did this, or here's how things are in the real world. You know, creatures aren't constantly cooperating with one another, and they aren't constantly fighting with one another, which is what creationists would want to have you expect. The way things actually are is creatures will trust one another up to a point, and the point is, you know, varies in different species, but it's basically to a point where you go past this, and you're not going to be trusted anymore. They give an example of a goldfish, or not a goldfish, some species of fish that would go with a partner to check out a predator that was in the area, and they'd both kind of inch toward it. And if one didn't inch forward, and they kept taking the same partner, they'd eventually stop taking that one because they aren't trusting the other person. And if they don't have a mutual relationship, then nothing's going to come out of it. Now, compassion to strangers and other things, that was not biological. That came with culture. And that probably naturally stemmed from the fact that being kind to other people, even though you might not get a direct benefit from doing that, you would kind of get this feeling that you're building up your reputation. And that's what it kind of stemmed from in the beginning. And it's gone on from there into a kind of worldwide feeling of morality. Then again, you might just want to take the simple course, and if a creationist tells you that you have no morals, ask him why you aren't going around murdering people. I mean, there has to be a reason for that, and usually when I tell him, you know, why, I ask him why am I not doing this, they'll tell me, well, you're afraid of the consequences of the law. And you gotta let them know who designed the laws. The people who designed the laws aren't a bunch of creationists. They're a bunch of people who have different, varied views that understand that people have basic human rights, that, you know, the right to life shall not be infringed, for instance. That's murder. Obviously, it's wrong. You don't have to accept a scientific theory in order to become a murderer. There are plenty of people throughout the history of humankind that have been creationist because the theory of evolution wasn't thought up until about the 1850s. There were people before that murdered people. That's all you need to let them know. And if they aren't true Christians or true creationists, once again, you can tell this is another example of creationists twisting logic in order to fit their odd view of reality. And with that claim taken care of, we'll move on to the second creationist claim for today, which is the famous, if we descended from monkeys, why are there still monkeys around? This basically stems from the fact that creationists don't seem to understand how evolution actually works. It's not a linear process. It involves a branching tree. They often like to picture it as a ladder, with human beings being the king of the ladder and pond scum on the bottom. Well, one species doesn't necessarily conquer another, otherwise we wouldn't have any more species now than we had 4.5 billion years ago. We just have one replacing another, replacing another, replacing another. In fact, why would there even be more than one species on the planet? There should only be one, according to their view, because if one is going to replace the next one, and, you know, ad infinitum, then we should only have one species. Obviously, this isn't the way things are, so creationists have a kind of problem when they think evolution is purely a linear process. As I said just a second ago, it's a branching tree. two species will often branch from a single one due to many things. There's geographic isolation, mainly. Sometimes they'll move a new habitat, but then again, this is geographic isolation. We could also have environmental issues that are going to affect the current population that will cause a change in the genes. There's also gene drifting, which is when two species kind of mingle and the genes get passed from one to another and we have a new species forming over time. Applying this logic to human beings, what the current view of the ape and human common ancestry is that their common ancestor, they diverged with them about 7 million years ago. Now this date was come up with by using what's known as the molecular clock method. What happens is they compare the DNA differences in apes and humans, and they take known mutation rates between, you know, in the DNA with each generation, and they say, well, if we extrapolate this backwards, using these mutation rates, we can see just about when these two DNA strands will match up. And so they get the date of about 7 million years ago. Now the common ancestor of apes and humans was not a monkey, it was an ape. Now, it's not an ape like today. It's not your modern gibbon or orangutan or gorilla. It was a earlier ape, but it still was an ape. It was not a monkey. And there are several differences between the two. For instance, monkeys have tails. Most monkeys have tails, at least, and apes do not. Monkeys will run on tree branches while apes will swing. And this is due to different skeletal structures that the two have. Apes also possess a higher capability for learning. They seem to have a more developed brain than monkeys do, and so we are able to teach them things, whereas monkeys, not so well. And both their cultures are different. I might just say apes have a higher, more developed capability of making culture. They have a more advanced culture, not compared to humans, but compared to monkeys. However, a monkey was the common ancestor of today's monkeys and the previous hominids, the earlier apes that we had, and they diverged about 18 million years ago. Now, going back to human evolution, Richard Leakey, who was a famous paleontologist, wrote in The Origin of Mankind that the formation of the Great Rift Valley about 12 million years ago began to separate species in eastern Africa, and this coupled with the change in climate that caused the forest to kind of develop into a woodland created varying evolutionary paths. Modern apes went one way and humans went the other. Now humans became bipedal, walking on two legs, because it was more energy efficient in the woodlands. It would not be practical for an ape to try to swing from tree to tree when the trees are spaced far apart. They would have to go on the ground and they could get attacked by predators more easily. Human beings, it's more energy efficient for them to walk on two legs across these distances, and so that helped, natural selection helped that aspect of human existence come along and followed with, you know, big brain size and culture, language, etc. We ultimately became what we are today. Then again, if you wanted to skip all this talk with the creationists and go straight to the point, ask them, why are there still Europeans around if Americans were once Europeans? It's the same principle with the apes turning into humans thing. It's not a linear process. And you could show that by asking them why they're Europeans around if Americans were there. I mean, if Americans are there, they should replace all the Europeans, in their view, if they're going to stick with the same logic they do with evolution. Obviously, they're going to say, well, this is not the same thing. Just ask them what the difference is. Just tell them that they are saying, well, it's a linear process for evolution, but I'm not going to say the same thing about, you know, Americans and Europeans. I'm going to change my view. And there's no real logical reason for them to do that. So with this example, you can demonstrate the failure of their logic here. All right, now that we're back, let's just hop right into the science topic for today, which is the scientific method, philosophical assumptions that scientists have to make when formulating theories, and why creationism and intelligent design are not science. Wikipedia's definition of science is that it is a system of acquiring knowledge based on empiricism, experimentation, and methodological naturalism. Now, empiricism is a philosophical view that states that knowledge can only be gotten through the senses. So if you observe something, that's knowledge that you've attained through your eyes, and same with smell and the other senses that you have. This has been part of the philosophy of science since its beginning. Obviously, observation is going to be a key part in attaining knowledge. Skipping over experimentation, because we all know what that is, let's discuss methodological naturalism. This part of this naturalistic view is that a stance of science that everything in nature has natural cause. Every observable thing, gravity or the wind, it's all going to have natural causes. Now, this shouldn't be confused with what is known as ontological naturalism, which assumes that the natural world is all that exists. This is my view, however, this is just my personal philosophy, and it has nothing to do with the philosophy of science. Science takes the view of methodological naturalism, which says nothing about the existence of the supernatural, but it simply assumes that natural things have natural causes. Jumping now to the scientific method, the method was first thought up by Sir Isaac Newton. He basically wanted a system for getting knowledge from the facts of the physical world around him. The scientific method is what eventually came about. It's obviously based on logic and uses hypotheses. The steps to this are observation, hypothesis again, prediction, experimentation, and conclusion. And I'm sure almost everyone went over this when they were doing high school science. But let's take an example. We'll do the Big Bang. I observe the universe expanding, which is what Edwin Hubble observed occurring in 1929. So I logically hypothesized that in the past it was smaller. I mean, it was bigger and it's growing, obviously. In the past, it was smaller. Here, I'm using my logic. So, using my logic again, I predict, well, because it's colder now, things are hot, they get dense. I predict there'll be a heat map of the universe left over from this kind of expansion, because the universe is so hot in the beginning that there should be some kind of temperature left over. Again, this is the cosmic background radiation that was predicted by scientists. And then I find it experimentally, like we did with Wilson and Arno Penzias. And so I conclude that the evidence is currently in favor of my view. Now, I need a lot more to have a theory than this just one piece of evidence. A scientific theory has to have a lot of explanatory power because it explains large amounts of evidence, and it'll do it logically, and it'll be in its favor. You have to test your hypotheses again and again and again before you even try to get theory status. And creationists and intelligent design advocates try to take advantage of the word theory because most people don't seem to know the difference between a scientific theory and a layman theory. A layman theory is a guess or an idea. You know, I wake up one morning and say, hey, I have a theory. This is not a scientific theory. You need repeated testing, and theories have to logically explain a lot of factual data in order to become a theory. Theories also do not evolve into laws. Laws are generalizations describing physical behavior. For instance, Newton's theory of gravity explains the force after taking into account numerous observations and their experiments. It can predict things. The gravitational law mathematically describes different interactions between certain massive objects. For instance, you have the Earth and the Moon, and Newton's law of gravity, can define the relation between the two and the force that is resulting from the different masses. Not all laws, remember, are mathematical. For instance, we have the laws of thermodynamics, which are not mathematically described. Basically, what you have to remember is that theories can predict things. They have predictive power. Laws will just explain interactions between things based on observation. I might as well, while I'm on the subject of semantics, begin to clear up the kind of view that creationists like to make the claim that evolution is a religion, and everything they say is dogma. The problem with this is that religion is a system of faith, and evolution is not faith. It's based on a large body of evidence, and it's the most logical view of how things became the way they did over the course of the history of the Earth, how things evolved. And because of the fact that we accept this is not religion, because there's no faith involved. Christians might say that certain aspects of evolution, like natural selection, for instance, is nothing but dogma. Dogma is something that religion involves because it's a view that they'll have that won't change no matter what the evidence says. For instance, with creationism, they have their biblical view of Genesis that's literal. Well, because the evidence goes against it, they'll just say, well, we'll throw away some of this evidence or reinterpret it until it fits our view. This is not the way science works. If there's evidence that can be logically interpreted in a different way, more logically than the other way, of course, then the view of science is going to change. Evolution would not stick around if suddenly we found creatures hopping from one species to another without any gradations. That's not how it would work. We would either alter the theory of evolution because so far it has shown itself to be correct, or we'd have to toss the theory altogether because it would not explain the data correctly. But with creationism, they just reinterpret the data until they think it makes sense in their view. And they're not afraid to admit this. If you go to Answers in Genesis' website and read their statement on how they kind of interpret things, they'll say, they say on their site that they interpret it in such a way that they know that the Bible is correct and that the evidence will verify it, basically no matter what happens. And so you see here that they're just going to interpret the evidence until it makes sense in their view, whereas science takes the stance of, if the evidence does not currently or does not go with our theory, then we're going to have to either alter our theory or study this occurrence more to see why exactly it's not matching up, and maybe it does match up, and we just haven't looked hard enough yet. There's also a difference between dogma and seeing something that's blatantly obvious in nature. Natural selection is blatantly obvious. There is a natural thing in the world and in the universe even that says something that is stronger and better fit will survive over the thing that is not. And this is simply because it's an obvious thing does not make it dogma if all the facts are in favor of it, which happen to be so, and observation is in favor of it. Again, this is empiricism. We're going back to what science is. There's nothing wrong with accepting natural selection. It's not dogmatic. It's not faith-based. It's nothing like that. It's not religion. It's observation, which verifies science, which is the theory of evolution. Lastly, I'd like to mention that science in general takes into account Occam's razor. This is what's known as parsimony. It was thought up by the English logician William of Ockham. He states that entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity. Now, what Ockham is basically saying here is that when you have a lot of explanations and that one is the most simple logically, that you shouldn't throw in extra factors to it. For instance, I see a tree and it looks like it's been struck by lightning. Well, I could say it's either been struck by lightning or aliens came in and decided to fry the tree. Now, logically, the lightning is more reasonable. Even if there's no thunderstorm going on, even if there hasn't been one in a few days, it makes a lot more sense than positing the existence of aliens. And so this is an example of what Occam's razor actually does. And tying this in to science and creationism, we see that creationists are trying to posit a supernatural explanation, and the same thing with intelligent design advocates. They're trying to throw in the supernatural when there already is a readily available natural explanation. So they're violating parsimony and Occam's razor, and this is one of the reasons why creationism and intelligent design fail at being science. Another reason why they fail at being science is because they cannot abide by the scientific method. How can someone who's testing for intelligent design look for non-design? I mean, they have to be able to falsify their claims. And if there's no such thing as non-design, how can they test for design? What I'm saying is there's no way to falsify their claim, and if you cannot falsify your claim, it's not science, it's dogma. It's also not possible to falsify a miracle that creationists need to explain the flood. It's not possible for creationists to explain the origin of the universe, making it 6,000 years old without twisting all of science into some kind of arbitrary view where they say, well, we're just going to bend special relativity until it fits our view. Einstein tried to do that with the cosmological constant, and he called it the greatest blunder of his life because it was basically an arbitrary factor, and he was denying the facts of reality that special relativity demonstrated that there had to be a beginning of the universe 14 billion years ago, approximately. So without falsifiability, they are not working within the scientific method, therefore they're not going to be scientific theories. In addition, we noted that theories have to have some kind of explanatory power. Now, how can ideists, that's intelligent designists, or creationists, how can they explain anything? How can the creationists predict what their God of the Bible is going to do? They all have different interpretation of what he wants to do. They're arguing over what creation is often. They admit that creationism happens, or they think it does, but they'll disagree on certain points of how the flood occurred, or how the origin of the universe, what happened there. So how can they agree? How do we trust one person who says, well, this is what God is telling me, this is what I predict is going to happen? They've predicted, for instance, that the universe, or that Jesus is going to return, you know, to the earth in a few years, and he's just going to come, and he's been almost here for about 2,000 years, you know, when is he going to come? And so they have no predictive power. And the same thing with intelligent design advocates who think, well, I think this is what design looks like. So what? You think design looks like that. The designer is smarter than you. He designed you. Obviously, he's going to do something that you don't even know what he's going to do. So why should we trust you on what he's going to say? They cannot predict anything because the necessity for their theory. It's just an arbitrary thing where the God or the intelligent designer, basically the same thing, they're going to do whatever they want to do, and the scientists on Earth, the creation scientists or the intelligent design guys, they can't predict anything. And without prediction, it's not a theory, it's also not science. Lastly, of course, the creationist claims and the claims of the intelligent design advocates, they've been falsified hundreds, if not thousands of times. From the claims about the global flood occurring to Michael Behe's irreducibly complex creatures, these arguments have been destroyed and just basically obliterated by all the scientists in any kind of field that is affected by these two theories, quote-unquote. And so to recap, we see that creationism and intelligent design fail at being science in many different ways. They can't explain anything. They aren't logically parsimonious. They don't fit Occam's razor. They involve redefining science to allow the supernatural in. Remember, science is based on methodological naturalism, which says that natural things have natural causes, and by throwing in the supernatural, creationists are trying to change this definition to fit their own view. Their claims have been also falsified hundreds of times. We especially saw intelligent design being basically destroyed by all the scientists in Dover, Pennsylvania, and we all know the outcome of that court case there. So basically, intelligent design was thrown out because it has no scientific basis and does not belong in the science classroom, even to be taught as an alternative theory. This is our show for today. This is all I have for you guys. However, I would like some input on some ideas, and I would also like some new ideas on how to add things to the show. I was thinking of throwing in a thing on missing links every week and just explaining a missing link. You know, creationists think that we don't have, for example, a missing a fossil between, say, reptiles and birds, and I could pull out Archaeopteryx, or we could do something on the horse or the intermediary fossil of the whale, anything like that. If you guys think that's a good idea, I'd like to hear some feedback. You need the email again, it is rlippens, that's LIPPENS, at wavecable.com. It's also on the blog and the RSS feed, but in case you forgot it or didn't know how to get to the blog, it's there. So, if you guys like that idea of the missing link, just email me, let me know. If you want anything else to be thrown in there, if you want less creationist claims or another science topic per week, just, again, email me. The next week's podcast topic is going to be a fun one because I like quantum mechanics, so we'll be discussing the basics of quantum theory, some certain aspects. I heard quantum entanglement often. People want to hear about that. It's a very bizarre thing where two objects that are spatially separated are somehow related, even though they can be further apart than it takes light to communicate between the two. And there are other odd things like quantum tunneling we'll be discussing, and how quantum theory was basically discovered and how it affects our view of the universe. So look forward to that as the podcast topic next week. So until then, I guess I'll be reading up on my quantum mechanics, and we will just discuss this next week.